Hello, fellow Kentuckians and other friends, and welcome to a new edition of my Old Kentucky podcast. As you may notice, it is me, Jasmine, doing the intro today, so Robert is not here. He is at a conference, so I am here today with a special guest. I have Cassie Chambers Armstrong here with me, and we're going to talk about her new book and her run for Metro Council, and then we're going to talk about what is going on in the General Assembly. So we'll go ahead and get started. Cassie Chambers Armstrong hails from Berea in Madison County, Kentucky, and she's also spent a lot of time with family in Owsley County. After graduating from law school, Cassie came back to Kentucky and worked with domestic violence survivors in rural communities. Cassie now lives in Louisville with her husband and her son, and she works as an attorney doing civil litigation. In 2018, she was elected as vice chair of the Kentucky Democratic Party. If you're a longtime listener, you may have remembered shortly after she was elected, she came on our podcast. Cassie's also the author of Hill Women, Finding Family and a Way Forward in the Appalachian Mountains. And she's also running for Louisville Metro Council District 8, which covers the Highlands neighborhood in Louisville. So Cassie, welcome back to my Old Kentucky podcast.
Thank you for having me. It's always good to be here.
So you were on the podcast about 2 years ago, shortly after you were elected vice chair of the KDP. And we mostly talked to you about the role that the state party plays in government and you know, what you hope to do in that position. And you talked about the 120 county strategy, which, you know, strives to have candidates running in all 120 counties. And you also talked about, you know, just going into communities and sharing what Democrats stand for and what our policies are instead of just what we're against. So talk a little bit about your first couple years as vice chair. You know, do you have any successes to share or things you feel like have worked well? And is there anything you might do differently?
Yeah, so I'm really proud of what we've been able to accomplish at the state party over the past 2 years. I think we've really been able to build a permanent campaign infrastructure that exists outside of any particular campaign, and that's allowed us to elect Democrats up and down the ballot. That's the purpose of having a permanent campaign infrastructure. And I think we really saw the results of that kind of organizing and that kind of infrastructure in the 2019 gubernatorial election, where we were able to recruit organizers around the state to knock 1 million doors, which is the most that has ever been knocked in any statewide campaign. And I think that's a really cool thing, and it shows that we're really doing the kind of grassroots organizing and infrastructure building that wins elections. Also, on a personal level, I'm really proud of the fact that I've been able to travel around the state and visit with different Democratic parties all over the place. I've gone to Estill County and Floyd County, and I've gone to Harlan, and I've also been living in Louisville. And I think what I've been able to do is have this perspective on our really urban areas in our state and our really rural areas in our state. And what's been really interesting for me is seeing the ways that there really is more that unites us than divides us within the Democratic Party, and that we really are one unified Democratic Party across the state. And so that's been a really interesting thing to be able to see up close and personal over the past couple of years.
And, you know, I think since you've been there, we have had a lot of Democrats running, which has been really great. And I think people, maybe me and Robert included, thought were a little bit worried when it got close to the filing deadline, and we didn't have that many that had filed, but I feel like we came through and we put people in a lot of those races. So I think the KDP is doing some good work.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I think we have some exciting candidates on the ballot, and I think we're going to compete in a lot of places. And I think it's just great to see some of these parties in areas that, you know, maybe went through a little bit of a period of not growing as much in the Democratic mm-hmm. Party, and now they're having this resurgence, and it's really great to see.
So let's talk about your book a little bit. So your book, Hill Women, was released just a few weeks ago, so you've now added author to your resume. Can you provide listeners a little bit of a synopsis about your book, and what made you decide to write a book, and specifically what made you decide to write about Eastern Kentucky?
Yeah, so the book traces three generations of women in my family, my granny, my mom, and me. And at its core, it's a book about each woman trying to do a little bit better for the next generation than she was able to have. And so my granny had a third grade education, lived in a house that was so cold at night that her blankets froze. And she desperately wanted a kid that was able to graduate high school and go to college. And that was my mom. And although my mom grew up poor, she was able to earn a scholarship to Berea College. And education so changed her life that she instilled in me its importance, and I was able to earn a scholarship to Yale College and graduate from Harvard Law. Another reason I wanted to write the book about women, you know, one, I thought that was an important story to tell, this story of women helping other women. But I also wanted to complicate people's views of Appalachia and their ideas mm-hmm. about what it means to be from Appalachia. A lot of people might be familiar with this other book about Appalachia that came out in 2016 that painted it as a place that was kind of hopeless and had a lot of problems. And that became a really popular way to think about mm-hmm. the area, just to see the problems that exist there. And it certainly does have problems, but what I have seen in my family members and my experiences with Appalachia is a lot of creative people, hardworking people, people with a lot of grit. And I didn't feel like that story was being told. So I wanted to tell that story and talk about all of the positive things in Appalachian communities.
I think that other book you mentioned is also being made into a movie.
So I'm told.
So maybe we need to see the Hill Women movie as a response to that one after it comes out.
I think the more portrayals we can have of Appalachia that counters some of the undertones of that, the better off we'll be.
All right. So you are also a Metro Council candidate right now. So you're running for Metro Council District 8. Talk a little bit about your decision to run for office and why you chose this office specifically.
Community has always been something that's been really important to me. When I was growing up, I did not have a lot, and I depended on community to provide me with, you know, things like a public education and healthcare, and I went to public libraries and played in public parks. And again, because I had that strong community and the community that also let my family be able to give me opportunities, I was able to go beyond, you know, what my wildest dreams when I was a child. And I've spent my career trying to pay that forward and really invest in community and make sure that other children have the opportunities that I had growing up. Mm-hmm. And that's something that's really just at my core, is I believe that we have to come together to provide opportunities for every child and every family. And so I decided that, you know, I was in the ability to devote all of my time to this, that I wanted to run for office and spend all day, every day, trying to make my little patch of the world a better place. I recently became a mom. I have a 6-month-old. And I think that, too, really just drove home for me. You know, I am raising my child in the Highlands. My husband, when he proposed, the first thing he said was, "Will you marry me?" And then he said, "Oh, and also, can we never leave the Highlands?" And so I'm contractually in this for life.
Yeah, you are.
And so I want, you know, my family and my child to grow up in the best neighborhood and the best community that we can be in.
So if you win your election, what are some major issues that you hope to tackle on Metro Council?
When I'm going out and I'm talking to people in the Highlands, what I hear is that they want a district, which most of us want. It's, you know, a district that is clean and green and safe and vibrant and diverse and inclusive. And what's really interesting is when you read the research, a lot of these things are entangled into one big knot. And it turns out, you know, if you do things like you pick up litter off the streets and you make things look nice, people walk more. They get out and they use the sidewalks. And that in turn decreases crime because you have more eyes out there sort of watching things. It also is good for businesses because you have more people walking around. And so the more you sort of, and it's also good for, you know, diversity and inclusion. You have neighbors talking to each other and building that sense mm-hmm. of community. And so what's really interesting is if you can start pulling on any of these threads, you disentangle that big knot. And so that's one of the things that I really want to focus on, is how we begin to pull on those threads.
And, you know, you mentioned that you'd be, you know, devoting your time to run for this race. And I'm sure that anyone can tell from listening to your bio that you've got a lot going on. How are you able to balance everything? And, you know, do you have any advice for others who, you know, might want to run for office but worry that they wouldn't have the time to do it?
So I did not expect to run for office with a 6-month-old. But now that I'm doing it, I really think it's an important thing for people, particularly young women, to see. Mm-hmm. I think women are told so often that you can run for office before you have kids or once your kids are grown.
Yeah, exactly.
And so we're really missing this perspective that is so important in any government, but particularly our local government, of women with young children. Mm-hmm. And we're talking about things like public libraries and public parks, and we're missing the perspective of a big group that spends a lot of time there. So I'm really into this idea of public mothering, of going out and just being a mom and being a candidate and being a public person, public-facing person. And I have taken my child with me to campaign events. I have taken him to community events. The interesting thing is there is always this tribe of people, you know, women mostly, that's mm-hmm. like, I will help you. I will hold him while you talk to the group.
Yeah.
I, you know, and so many people, I think it gives them a sense of hope to see sort of a young mom running, and it's something they're not used to seeing, and everyone has just been so helpful and supportive. So what I would say is it certainly helps to have a supportive family and have supportive friends, but also don't underestimate even just sort of random people in the world who want to help and want to be a part of what you're trying to build, because I've certainly encountered a lot of those.
And I guess I have kind of another question about the specific seat that you're running for. So this is a seat that a lot of people ran for in the last election, and Brandon Cohn ended up winning and then said that he wasn't going to seek another term. Is this office something that you thought about well before that, or was it kind of like a thing where you just saw this opportunity with someone stepping down? Just, I guess, when did you start to think about it?
I would say after I had my child, the only thing I was thinking about in that immediate aftermath was having a child and figuring out how to be a mother. But when Brandon announced that he wasn't going to run, I had been spending a lot of time in the neighborhood and in the community because I'd been on maternity leave. I'd been walking around pushing my kid in his stroller for 16 weeks. And I think you just see your neighborhood in a different way. Mm-hmm. And I'd been looking for something in life that would make me feel like I was really investing in community and making that tangible difference in the way I wanted. And it just seemed like it all came together. And I was like, this is something that I really want to do. I want to devote all of my time and energy to making this little patch of the earth the best that it can be. And so I decided, you know, it's not the best timing on paper. It wasn't something that I had planned, but I decided I'm going to jump in, and I'm so glad that I did it, and I'm having a really great time and meeting really interesting people.
Well, I definitely wish you luck in your race, and I think you're a great example for other women.
I think it's good. I decided to jump in because I'd seen other women like Josie Raymond doing this sort of thing with young kids.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I hope other women look at this and say, I can do it too.
She's definitely who I thought about when you mentioned you taking your child to campaign events and things like that. And congratulations to her. She just had a baby girl.
Yes.
So last but not least, where can people find your new book, and how can they get involved in your campaign if they'd like to?
So the book is now in stores. Please buy local, go to Carmichael's, get it. You can also get it online if for some reason you can't make it to Carmichael's or your local bookstore. And you can find out more about the campaign at www.CassieChambersArmstrong.com or on Facebook. We have a campaign Facebook page.
All right. So thank you so much for sharing about your campaign and your new book and everything you have going on. And our listeners are very lucky this week because you are going to stick around with me and talk about the news and the General Assembly.
I'm excited.
All right. I will start with what's going on in the Senate. I just wanted to mention a few bills that have passed or new things that have been filed. So last week on the show, we talked about Senate Bill 8, and that is the bill that would require armed school resource officers in schools. That bill passed the Senate 34-1. Senator Morgan McGarvey was the only no vote. Senator Gerald Neal filed an amendment that would basically leave the decision up to the local school boards, which I think is, you know, something we talked about last week, that maybe this is a decision that should be up to local school boards, but that amendment was quickly defeated, so that bill will move on to the House.
Interesting.
Senate Bill 2, that's the photo ID bill. We have talked about that, I think, every week since the General Assembly started, and it passed 29-9 along party lines. So that bill will also be moving on to the House.
This is one that I think people are watching very closely.
Yeah, and I think, you know, they made it a little bit better than it could have been. I still think really a lot of these bills that I'm mentioning today are bills that solve a problem that we don't have. So we're, you know, we're spending money for solutions when there isn't a lot of evidence that, or any, that we have a problem. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the Senate also voted 32-0 to pass Senator Whitney Westerfeld's Born Alive Infants Bill. I think we maybe only mentioned this in passing, but this bill would require healthcare professionals to provide life-saving care to infants who are born alive after failed abortions. Westerfeld was asked if he, you know, knew any instances of this happening, and he did not. And I think, you know, healthcare professionals have said our ethics require us to do this anyways. We're always required to provide life-saving care. And, you know, what the bill also does is it creates a Class D felony for any violation of this law. And as our listeners know, I'm always against bills that create new felonies because I think we have plenty. Robbie Mills also filed SB 114. This is a bill that would require Kentucky school districts to designate sports teams based on biological sex of students. So, you know, one team for boys, one team for girls. And just a really crazy part of this bill is that it would also allow students to sue the school if they encountered someone of the opposite biological sex in the locker room, which I just can't believe that's something that's been filed in the legislature, but here we are.
And I understand that there are a lot of similar bills like this one that are being filed around the country. So it seems to be part of a concerted effort to get legislation like this passed.
Yeah, I definitely think that's true. I think there's, you know, model legislation that different groups are providing to states, and they're just like, here, see what we can do with this. And I think this is one of those issues. And we're going to talk about another anti-trans bill when we start talking about the House as well. We also have the new Marcy's Law, which is SB 15. And I'm surprised that I waited this long to talk about it because I've spent a couple years railing on Marcy's Law, but we have the new one. So it's exactly the same as SB 3, which was the bill that passed a couple years ago, except that it will publish the full text of the amendment, and they added a requirement that victims be given timely notice and the right to be heard in the consideration of any pardon, commutation, granting of a reprieve, or other matter. So I believe this is probably a response to Governor Bevin's pardons, right?
Yes, it certainly seems like it.
Right. So the new ballot question will say, are you in favor of creating a new section of the Constitution of Kentucky relating to crime victims as proposed in Section 2 below? And then Section 2 below will be the entire amendment. So, you know, if listeners remember, the Kentucky Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers challenged this law, arguing that the ballot question was too vague. And the Supreme Court of Kentucky not only said that this question was too vague, they said, we believe the Constitution requires that any constitutional amendment be published in full to the voters. So from now on, that's something that we're going to see. So they will have to publish the full text of the amendment if this law passes. And it's about 2 pages long, so it'll be a lot of information for voters to read if it's on their ballot.
Better bring their reading glasses to the polling places.
Right. And Robert has said this before, that the Supreme Court of Kentucky ruling would encourage bills to have shorter amendments, but it's the same as it was last year with an addition of, you know, pardons and commutations and things like that. But the bill has been debated on the Senate floor, and Senator John Schnickel spoke out against it and said that it's a bill that's been heavily lobbied by interests in California, which is true. Like, that's where this bill was first passed, and it is heavily lobbied. There are celebrities and their commercials, so I don't think that's an unfair thing to say. But Senator Westerfield called out John Schnickel, called him a hypocrite because he has supported bills backed by out-of-state money before. And then in response to that, we got Senate Bill 113 from John Schnickel that basically would keep out-of-state money out of Kentucky lobbying. So I think he got a little fired up and then filed a bill in response. Those are the big things going on in the Senate. I think the biggest two things are, you know, we have SB 2 heading to the House as well as SB 8. But Cassie's going to tell us a little bit about what's been going on in the House.
Yeah. So in the House this week, first up, Kevin Bratcher, he's a Republican out of Louisville, filed a bill to automatically expunge acquittals and dismissals with prejudice.
So I thought this was worthy of just mentioning only because it's a criminal justice bill that's filed by a Republican. And Kevin Bratcher is also a Republican who is in a district that Democrats could potentially take. So I think that this is a really good bill because as it stands, if you're acquitted at trial or, you know, you go to court and they realize they don't have grounds to prosecute your case or something like that, and they dismiss it, it still shows up on your record. So I would hopefully think that this doesn't have a ton of opposition, because if you're acquitted, you know, that should disappear from your record. And I would guess that a lot of people feel that way. So I think this is a good bill, but as with a lot of criminal justice bills, we don't know if it's going to even get a hearing.
Yeah. And I do think it's interesting the way, I think it's just evidence that expungements, the way people are looking at them, is changing over time. I think now expungements, the need for access to them and all the implications around it, it's highlighted so much. And so I think that might have something to do with this as well.
And I think that this is something that a lot of people don't know. They expect if they went to court and their charge was dismissed, that's the end of it. But I've had clients before that tell me, that was dismissed, and then this employer found out about it. And so I definitely think this is a fair bill, but we'll see if it goes anywhere.
And so then next up this week, James Tipton has filed House Bill 298, and that bill would require all police departments to establish policies on vehicle chases. But the policies would be secret and could not be disclosed to the public under the Open Records Act. So that's interesting, because in Kentucky we have really strong open records laws where almost all government records or public records can be disclosed.
Yeah, and you know, something to note here is that police car chases have been kind of a subject in the media lately, and I think it's worth noting that, you know, a police car chase where two teenagers died, the passenger teenager settled for $1 million in 2019 in Louisville. And so it seems like an odd time that we'd be making police policies on chases secret and not subject to open records.
And then next up, we have House Bill 321, where Savannah Maddox filed that bill. And I'm quoting here from it: it would prohibit medical professionals from performing surgeries or prescribing medications to a minor with the intent to alter the sex the child was assigned at birth, and create a Class D felony and a civil cause of action for violations. So, you know, this is one of those anti-trans bills that you were talking about earlier, where, you know, this is part of several bills that have been filed that are really sort of seeking to limit the rights of transgender people, particularly youth.
Yeah, and Philip Bailey of the Courier-Journal did a story on a trans candidate for state house. Ramona Thomas is running for state house in Louisville. And so, you know, if these issues are something that matter to you, you should definitely check out Philip Bailey's article and Ramona Thomas's campaign. And Cassie, you also mentioned before we recorded that it was worth noting that there is a statewide fairness bill. So there are good LGBTQ bills, but we just don't think or don't know if they're going to go anywhere.
Yeah, I think it's good to maintain hope. So I wanted folks to know statewide fairness on the ballot in the legislature.
If there's something to have hope about, it's that Kentucky Fairness has had like four or five more cities just in the last month or two pass their own fairness ordinances. But it would be nice if we could get a statewide law.
Absolutely. And then we finally have House Bill 1. It is a public assistance reform bill. The chief sponsor is this is David Mead, and that bill would allow the state to temporarily pay private health insurance premiums for people who make up to 200% of the federal poverty level. It also creates a work requirement for some people. If 75% of the money the state spends on Medicaid were to go to the expanded Medicaid population, people in the expanded Medicaid program for over a year would have to complete an 80-hour work requirement each month.
Right. So this is a little bit similar to, you know, what the Bevin administration tried to do with our Medicaid expansion. But there are a lot of moving parts to this bill, and I think that we'll do a deep dive into this bill in the coming weeks. But we just wanted to mention that House Bill 1 has finally been filed, and then we'll talk about it more later. All right, so we also have to talk about the budget address. So Governor Beshear gave his budget address last evening, and I think the theme of it was definitely education. The governor said that his proposal will add funding to public education without spending cuts from the general fund. He also proposed a plan for new tax revenue. So proposed tax revenue amounts to $147.7 million over the next 2 years. And so that's assuming that they pass a 10-cent increase on packs of cigarettes and other tobacco products a new tax on vaping products, and a bill to legalize and tax sports betting in Kentucky, and an increase of the minimum limited liability entity tax from $175 to $225. So that is Beshear's tax revenue plan. The budget also seeks to fully fund the teacher's retirement system, increase the SEEK funding formula by 1%, and restore textbook funding. And while the budget does include bond funding for physical improvements to like school building security, it does not include funding for the school safety bill that passed last year, which would hire more school safety officers and mental health counselors. So I think some people were upset to see that the budget proposal did not include that funding.
I do think this was framed very much as a pro-education budget. And I think when mm-hmm. you look at the funding, that was what all the headlines are talking about, is the, you know, this was a pro-education budget and Governor Bevin keeping his promises to educators.
Right. And I think aside from education, another big thing that I noticed was he included adding 350 social workers to investigate and oversee child protection. And the state definitely needs more social workers. And they also need a way to retain social workers. So that was something I definitely noticed about it as well. Senate President Stivers and Speaker Osborne made a pretty big deal about not being briefed beforehand. And they also expressed criticism about the proposal. And, you know, of course, the legislature doesn't have to accept his recommendations. They're kind of in charge here. And, you know, though the governor is the one who ultimately signs or vetoes the budget, the legislature can override his vetoes with a majority, which Republicans have in both chambers. And so, you know, I think Senate President Stivers and Speaker Osborne were, you know, making a big deal about not being briefed and saying things like, you know, so much for a new era and so much for getting us involved and working together. So I guess it kind of turned out to be a bad look that they didn't get to see any of the budget proposal before. Even Senator Morgan McGarvey, who's a Democrat, mentioned that they didn't get to see it. So we'll see if Beshear, you know, is able to have time to inform the legislature of things like this in the future. It may have just been a time crunch thing. I really don't know why that didn't happen, but some of the legislators were upset about it.
Well, now let's move on to Good Bill, Bad Bill.
Yeah, so this is a segment that we do periodically during the General Assembly. So you get to hear a lot of bills that I like and that Robert likes and bills that we don't like. But today we're going to let Cassie tell us about a good bill and a bad bill.
Yeah, so for the good bill, I have House Bill 199. There's a companion bill that is Senate Bill 85. And those bills would ban conversion therapy. And conversion therapy sort of falsely claims that it's going to be able to change folks' sexual orientation and gender identity. Conversion therapy uses traumatic, sometimes painful methods. And it's been linked to things like depression and anxiety and increased suicide among LGBTQ youth. It's also, it's been denounced by every major medical organization, so it's not something that the medical establishment thinks is good or works. And the issue of conversion therapy, it's been getting a lot of coverage in the media lately. There have been stories in The Courier and just all over the news. And even some members of the religious community have spoken out against it, in part because of the trauma it causes. So it's still unclear whether these bills are going to have the bipartisan support they need to get passed. But there is at least some bipartisan support, and it's in the media. It's an issue that's getting a lot of attention. So it could be that we see this legislation start to move and get conversion therapy banned in Kentucky.
And, I think it's a big thing that the Senate bill does have a Republican sponsor. We've mentioned this bill in passing, but haven't really talked about it a lot. But Senator Alice Forgy Kerr is who's sponsoring the Senate bill. And I've seen one or two people criticize her online saying, oh, well, it's an election year and her district is maybe trending more Democrat, so she might be at risk. And that's why she, you know, reached out this olive branch. But I don't think it's that. I do think Senator Forgy Kerr supports LGBTQ issues. So I think she comes at this from a very sincere place. And I hope that she can get other Republicans on board. I think bills like this have a lot more momentum now. I think Utah just became the 19th state to ban it. So even if it doesn't come this year, I think that this will pass eventually.
Yeah, some of the stories that are out there are just so horrific that I think
they are. So we hope that this bill can get passed this year, but if not, soon.
So we're rooting for the good bill. And then a bad bill, we have House Resolution 45. I'll note it is not a House bill, but it does urge the General Assembly to reject red flag laws. And those are laws that basically allow a court to enter what's called an extreme risk protective order to remove guns from a person who's found to basically be a substantial risk to themselves or others. It might be that they're going through a mental health crisis or, you know, there's some reason that you think, and actually a court thinks that this is someone that shouldn't have a gun right now. So, you know, this is just a resolution, but it is important because we do expect Senator Morgan McGarvey and Senator Hornback, Morgan McGarvey is a Democrat, Senator Hornback is a Republican, to introduce a red flag bill very soon to allow red flag orders to be entered because they announced in November that they were close to finalizing bipartisan legislation on this. So this resolution is a signal that that bill, whenever it's introduced, may face some pretty serious opposition.
And so this resolution, I think it had 15 sponsors, and you know, the bill that we think is going to be filed, you know, is a bipartisan bill, but this House resolution is also bipartisan. One of the sponsors of the House resolution is also a Democrat. It'll be interesting to see the breakdown, you know, when we have a bill on this issue. All right, so that is all for this week. Thank you so much, Cassie, for coming on and talking with us today.
Thanks for having me.
You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at @myoldkypod. You can like our Facebook page and listen to our podcast on the podcast app of your choice. We also have a newsletter that comes out on Friday mornings. You can subscribe to it at fordky.com/email, and you can also subscribe to their other newsletters. We also have a Patreon page where you can support what we do for as little as $1 a month. You can do that at patreon.com/myoldkentuckypodcast. And last but not least, we are part of the Demcast Network. Thanks for listening.
One song for your Kentucky home, for your Kentucky home, far away.